C-axis vertical crystal with the C-axis pointing directly towards you. These blades are crystals in which the C-axis is tilted to your view. After we get the first layer of ice forming, we start getting pressure bulges forming in the centers due to the trapped water not being able, there's not enough room left in the stream for all the water to flow, so it starts building up pressure. Later on, we'll get cracks in here, and the water will eventually break through and form the first overflow. As a matter of fact, you can see there's some water forming along the edges here. It also comes out of the cracks and also along the edges. This is a view of the edge with the upturned ice. The water flows out and it almost stands on end on the sides of the stream. Here we are, the 31st of December. The stream is completely filled. There's about a meter of ice in here now, and we're still having an overflow. Temperature was about, I think, about 30 below here. Here we have one on the 15th of January. I had just walked through an overflow here, and it was about 35 below centigrade, so you can't always trust walking on the snow. There might be water under even very cold temperatures. I think the I'll go on to my this is a graph representing some of the physical measurements we made during freeze-up. Freeze-up started over here and we had complete freeze up here. We measured the electrical conductivity, and you can see that it increases as you freeze, just indicating that you're forcing the impurities out of the water. Here's the ambient air temperature, the water temperature varying, and also the water elevation had the highest elevation matching with the coldest temperatures, indicating that this frazzle ice slows down the stream velocity, therefore creating an increase in water elevation. The next graph shows the relationship between the temperature, maximum and minimum temperatures, plotted against the stream elevation, whether it be water or ice. Here we had the first frazzle ice formation in increasing the water level, and then we had a succession of overflows coming at specific times. It wasn't one complete overflow. At various stages in here, we installed thermocouples at different levels in the ice to measure temperature distribution, and I'll show you that in just a second here. Most of the overflows occurred at a time when we had a maximum temperature. These are the isotherms on, this was in January, the 24th of January. The temperature up here was minus 24.5 degrees centigrade up above the snow surface. And as you can see, we had water running in the stream at both sides. We found water running in the stream most of the year until about in the latter part of January, when the stream was entirely froze up. This is Dr. Benson. We started excavating a trench. This was so we could study the stratigraphy of the area, and I did the petrofabric analysis of the stream ice. Here we are. We used a portable generator and an iron to iron the ice, to smooth it up, and we got very good pictures that way. We had a nice glossy surface. This Dr. Benson. We got a lot of stares from people driving across the bridge. This is one of our helpers. The trench is finally getting down to the bottom. You can see the layering effect in it. Here's a clear layer, and we're getting down to the bottom part of the trench there. Here's some we're looking right directly at the bottom of the stream. There's some very large flat air bubbles from the air being trapped down in there. It can't escape anymore if we've had freeze up, and it flattens out instead of forming long tubular air bubbles. Here's a shot of the end of the trench. Can't quite see everything. The bottom of the stream down here, and we have a series of overflow layers, clear overflow. Here there was some snow on the stream. We had a clear overflow and percolated down through the snow. Here we had more snow, another clear overflow. Here we have some organic material. We had about 10-15 centimeters of this brown organic material. This overflow occurred in January after apparently everything was frozen up, but we did get quite a bit of this material. Here's a picture of some of the frazzle ice that was preserved in the bottom layer of ice. You can see as much as 15 to 20 centimeters off the bottom of the stream. You have this milky looking ice with rocks, pieces of sticks, large rocks there, frozen up into the ice. Here's the ice block that I did the petrofabrics on, and you can just see the various snow ice, clear overflow ice layers. Here's the layer of that organic material with another layer of organic material there. This was a finer material than this, and then the last snow ice layer. This is a close-up of that organic material with very minute air bubbles and so forth, with this large flattened out air bubble down here. Now this is the represents a stream from the very bottom. I think this must be an upside down. This would be the bottom of the stream. You have the long tapered crystals. They just keep getting wider with depth. Then you have a series of overflow layers. This would be snow ice here. Here we have a clear overflow. And in this layer here, I found some C-axis vertical crystals to be predominant, indicating different temperature at which the overflow occurred. And then this is some more snow ice here. Here is some of the frazzle ice that was preserved for us, like the bottom of the stream being down here, long tapering crystals. And here's the frazzle ice incorporated in this bottom layer of ice, with a layer of snow ice up above it and another clear overflow layer up above that. This is the horizontal view of some of the bladed crystals, in which we found the C-axis to be perpendicular to these blades. In other words, the stream would be flowing in this direction. This is a typical horizontal section of ice, and you really couldn't tell the difference between this and quartz. This is the type that's most commonly found of the horizontal section. Here's some of the bladed ice. That's long bladed crystals with the stream again flowing in this direction. Now that it wasn't always perpendicular to the blades. As a matter of fact, sometimes the stream flow was parallel to the blades, just depending upon the conditions under which it was frozen. Oh, went the wrong way. Here, this represents the very bottom ice, and this was the very first surface to freeze. And you can see the crystals are very small, and up here there were a lot of vertical oriented crystals. With depth, these vertical crystals become wedged out by the horizontal crystals, and then they predominate on depth, so that with depth all you would get would be a horizontal C-axis crystal. The crystals can be quite large. This is a centimeter grid, and I've measured crystals as much as 36 centimeters square. Now, this is right before the breakup occurred. You can see the stream is entirely covered with snow. It's entirely filled. This was the area of our trench right in here. The first indication of breakup, you start getting water forming in the center along the edges of the stream. It comes up into cracks and it starts filling in the trench there. You see there's some water there. And the water infiltrates, runs under the snowpack so that you really don't know whether you're going to step down into water or solid ground during this time of the year. Here the water is beginning to get deeper on the stream. It can't flow in the stream, so it has to flow on top of it. And the water is about its maximum depth here. It'll get a little bit deeper. You can see it's starting to peel off some of the layers. Some of the ice is starting to just erode off the top. And it erodes off layer by layer until the last ice out was the first ice that was formed. Here's a piece being torn off and ripped up, and I'll show one more. Here. This graph represents how the ice goes out on 29 April. This is the water surface here. This is the ice surface. And these were the various layers in the stream with a thermocouple points. The 1st of May, this much ice had eroded out and so forth. It goes out in layers. It might be a patchy type arrangement. The entire layer may not go out. Until the 8th of May, this is what we had left, and then a few days later this entire block just rose up and broke up and floated out. So that the last slide we have here represents a stream back to its normal old self. You can see there was quite a bit of erosion going on. The banks have slumped in, and a good indication that the ice goes out from the top down is that our pipes that we installed here at the first of the year are still there. Whereas if the ice went out all at once, the pipes would have gone with it. And this was our shack there on the net show. All right, I think that's about all the slides I have. Yeah.
I'm sure Mr. Kretschner did a better job of presentation here than Professor Benson would have done. This ambidextrous deal of handling two different slide projections was very cleverly carried out, I thought. The organic material in the ice, I presume that is derived from the overflow as the water comes in from over the banks of the ice. Is that your...
It's plant material. We really don't know exactly where it comes from. It hasn't been studied in detail, the formation of it. We noticed that whenever the overflow occurred, that the entire stream was brown, which is organic material. We're not aware of how it originated.
Any other questions? Yes.
Yeah, I know Carl's familiar with the North Slope, but you know how he applies this process of creating the thawing or breakup to the North Slope streams, where these stream channels, at least the major ones, considerably different process.
I wouldn't think that the
cross-section of the stream would have much effect on it. I think probably the greatest effect would be the depth of the stream, whether or not the stream flows all the way to the bottom. If the stream didn't freeze all the way to the bottom, you'd have room for this winter water, and you wouldn't have such an overflow problem. If the stream did construct the channel, or constrict the channel, you'd have the same type of problem that you have here.
Yes.
It's possible to say how deep the stream has to be before it reaches the bottom.
Well, the stream was about a meter deep, and it froze all the way to the bottom in January. But there was water running in until. So I hesitate to give it the depth. I'd say that at least a meter.
Any other questions? I suspect that they're working on some scheme to beat this pool on the Chena outbreak. Find out exactly how the ice forms and breaks up. Maybe they'll have something. Make a fortune for science. Yes, one more question, I'm sorry.
Were you able to detect any water beneath the gravel or in the gravel on the stream bed? Any unfrozen material in the stream bed?
No, the only way that we could have indication of water flow was from a thermocouple measurement. We did have some thermocouple bearings in the soil in the stream bed, which indicated there was water running. We had thermocouple buried in the stream bed itself, and that was the only indication that we had water running. We didn't actually see them. Temperature measurements every week and made a perfect cross section of the stream, and from this we could tell where the water was running.
I understand the coffee has arrived, so we'll take a 10-minute break for coffee, and please try to get back in 10 minutes. If we come to order, we'll proceed with the session. I have three urgent messages. One for Mr. George, I think it's Shrock, S-H-A-R-R-A-K, if I read this. George Shrock. The other one is for Chang Craft. C-R-A-F-T. And the third one for Mr. Bailey. All I have is Mr. Bailey. But apparently there are urgent messages for these three gentlemen at the desk. We'll proceed to the next paper, which is entitled Construction Drilling in Snow, Ice, and Frozen Ground. And we'll hear from Mr. Russell A. Page of the U.S. Naval Civil Engineering Laboratory at Port Hueneme, California, again.
Okay, thank you. Construction operations in the polar regions often require an efficient method of drilling large diameter holes in snow, ice, and frozen ground. Construction drilling is often needed for wells, antenna guy wire anchors, utility poles, pile foundations, and in coastal regions, bollards for ship docking. In the McMurdo Sound region, the lack of adequate drilling equipment and techniques has hampered construction activities. They found early that the truck-mounted power-driven augers were of no use whatsoever in the frozen ground there because it's so rocky and the subsurface temperatures were so low. So we started a little bit of experimental drilling with different bits and whatnot to determine the best means of producing large diameter holes quickly and efficiently. This work was done around McMurdo Station between 1966 and 1968. Because of current construction of McMurdo, this area provided an opportunity to test drilling equipment under actual operating conditions. The varying terrain permitted experimental work in frozen ground, volcanic rock, sea ice, fast ice within inclusions of rock and rock debris, glacier ice, and deep snow.
Get the lights here and a little location. Okay. Oops. I'm backwards here. This is just an overall map of the area showing Ross Island. The Navy station of McMurdo is right here on the end of Hut Point Peninsula. This is the Ross Ice Shelf, changing to the McMurdo Ice Shelf. These are vectors showing ice flow directions only. And a little closer local map. Again, McMurdo Station, the supplies for the inland stations to the logistic support for all the research comes to McMurdo predominantly by cargo ship. And the ship's anchor here in Winter Quarters Bay. The cargo is then rehandled, reshipped to Williams Field. This is a misnomer, it's really supposed to be a skiway. From here, the cargo to the outlying stations such as Bird, Hole, Hallett, etc., is flown by the ski wheel equipped Hercules aircraft operating on deep snow of the McMurdo Ice Shelf. The alternate ice runway, which I mentioned previously, is out here at Outer Williams Field, and it's predominantly for wheeled aircraft. It can also be used by the Hercs when the wind conditions are not dry or this area might be fogged in. The annual sea ice runway is used from September to mid or late January when it begins to get too thin to support the heavy cargo aircraft. So this is the McMurdo Sound complex. It's all spoken of in McMurdo Station, but it involves Williams Field and Outer Williams Field and all of the facilities necessary to provide logistic support for research. This is a view of the city of McMurdo. I mentioned it had a... A large population in the summertime of about 1,000 men, usually 200 to 300 men or 250 men winter over during the winter. This is where the cargo ships come in, Winter Quarters Bay, docking along here. The docking area consists of fast ice, which is defined as old sea ice that is frozen to and accumulated along the shore. It's not easily seen anymore because it's covered with an artificial fill of 20 to 24 inches of dirt, mostly to provide a good working area and a traffic area for the cargo trucks to move the cargo on up into the main station complex. Pretty tricky. Again, just another view of McMurdo Station showing the tanks and cargo storage yards. It's become quite an enormous operation. Construction drilling in this area is needed for a variety of reasons. You need utility poles for power distribution, communication line distribution. And here, our mobile drill rig unit, which we use as a driving unit for the experimental drilling, is putting in a utility pole near the power plant. Another need is for pile foundations to support the sewer outfall system. And it's pretty tough putting the holes down in this frozen ground and rock. The frozen ground in McMurdo here varies. There's not much of a variety. Solid basalt with ice in joints and vesicles and other openings. The worst material is what I call ice rock conglomerate, merely for ease of discussion. It's angular fragments of basalt of all sizes and shapes frozen together in a matrix device. You'll see some pictures of it later. And it's pretty tough stuff to drill through. Again, we're drilling angle holes for bollards. This is along Winter Quarters Bay, and the cargo ships come in here and tie up. They like to be able to tie up and stay put safely in occasional 80 to 100 knot wind loads. So it takes a pretty good hole and a pretty good tie up for the cargo ships. This again is our drill rig, and we're drilling in ice. We've drilled through the 18 inches of fill. This is the drill rig we've used. You see the slide didn't come out quite the way. It's a model of 40BL, I think, mobile drill rig, and it was used for all the experimental drilling. Could have the lights for a moment, but I'll just shut these off or let these fade away for the time being. We tried various diameters of augers in snow and ice, which worked well within limits. The limitation is mostly depth. In sea ice, it's easy to drill through the ice sheet with auger of almost any diameter, up to 24 inches. In snow, the depth limitation is produced by the fact that the cold, the snow, the cuttings are very granular, and they run like sugar, and they run right off your auger flights. And this is kind of a problem. You can get a hole down to about 8 feet without too much trouble, but from then on, it's not too easy. We tried two or three different diameter tricone bits, which worked pretty well for shallow holes in the frozen ground, using both drilling fluid, either diesel oil or seawater, or sometimes in midsummer there's a pond of fresh water available for drilling fluid, and we've used compressed air. The tricone bits work pretty well for smaller diameter holes. We've tried to work on the old CB formula, the old KISS formula, which means keep it simple, stupid. And this, amazingly enough, worked out the best device we found for drilling large diameter holes. And with selection and fabrication in the field, you can drill holes of almost any diameter you want. I see the lights again now. I think the next picture or two will be the... We just simply called it a tube coring drill. Okay, now the lights, we'll see what's coming along here. Okay, this is a picture of it drilling in sea ice, which it does very easily and very efficiently. It's simply a piece of pipe. This one was 14 inches in diameter, 9 feet long. The cutting edge was reinforced by adding another rim or two of steel from the same pipe. The upper end was adapted for the 2 1/4 inch diameter drill rod we used. The cutting edge was then made into a castellar shape, you know, like a castle around, and faced with a 1/4 to 1/8 inch diameter tungsten carbide chips and a special brazing alloy matrix. And the whole thing can be field fabricated if necessary. The hard facing can be done in about 2 hours. It does wear away, and it has to be re-hard faced again, depending upon the material you're drilling in. But this thing, very simple, very economical, simply drilled through everything. And we put down holes 6 feet deep, 14 to 15 inches in diameter, in solid rock in about 2.5 hours. And this had not been done in the Myrtle area before. It worked very well in this so-called ice rock conglomerate. There's no whipstocking or drifting effect. It drilled right on down through it. Larger diameter holes couldn't be produced. Some of the utility holes had 20 and 24 inch diameter butts. And holes of this size were produced by warming up the water we used as the drilling fluid, which in turn, during the drilling process, melted the ice. This caused a lot of caving in, and the hole had to be kept cleaned out. And at depths much deeper than 6 or 8 feet, it became awfully difficult and quite inefficient. I don't recall any more pictures of this. This sort of get a little focus here. These are some samples of the ice rock conglomerate. It turned out a little bit dimmer than I thought. Showing large masses of ice, dirty ice, with large and small fragments. Some of these were two or three large fragments of rock frozen together. I think it's easy enough for you to visualize what the material was like. and it was cold. Just a few feet down, the temperatures, even in midsummer, were about 10 degrees Fahrenheit, and a little bit deeper down the mean annual temperature of about 0 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's cold permafrost and rocky, and this in turn introduces other problems. Some of the holes were required for bumper posts around some of the buildings to protect the buildings from occasionally wild CB drivers. And these holes are drilled in frozen fill with moisture content ranging anywhere from 20 to 60 or 70% depending upon what the fill was like when it was brought in place. The advantage of the tube coring drill is that the spoil is removed and disposed of as a solid mass. A phase of construction drilling is really sort of exploratory drilling whereby you might want to study the foundation condition before erecting a large structure. Again, a good undisturbed sample can be acquired from a large diameter core, and further sampling and subsurface information can be acquired from the sides of the hole. So it worked out very good. These are some cores of fast ice from the McMurdo ice core. We cored, used this thing to a depth of 60 feet successfully. The deeper you go, the more the risk increases tremendously from the standpoint of getting the darn thing jammed in. To a depth of 9 feet, the annular space between the wall of the hole and the outside of the drill is very small, and it doesn't take the uphole velocity of your drilling fluid is sufficient to remove the cuttings quite well. But once you go into a hole deeper than 9 feet, now the annular space between the 2-inch diameter drill rod and the 14-inch diameter hole is pretty rough, and the water velocity or your compressed air velocity is lost and no longer removes cuttings. And this is a big problem for drilling deeper holes. You can do it, but the risk increases, the risk and efficiency decrease. The risk increases and the efficiency decreases with depth, put it that way. This is another sample of frozen fill from an area where they now are erecting a large building, and some of this was for sampling at depth to determine foundation information for the foundation design. Again, this is a core of solid basalt. The ice in the joints near the surface has melted away broken up a little bit, and you can see how the core has broken up. It took about 2 hours and 20 minutes to drill 6 feet, and this is solid basalt. The inclusions are olivine. This is right at the McMurdo station. This is looking down the hole. A little bit of water and a little bit of core left in the hole, but it was in a very short time we were able to put in a utility pole. Previously, the CBs had used jackhammers, they tried jet burning holes, really very inefficient. The jet burners would eventually produce a hole which usually ended up with nothing more than a great bowl of warm soupy mud, which was not very well suited for utility poles, bollards, or any of the other construction needs. So this simple device worked quite well, and it works very well in ice, the tube coring drill. The diameter can be selected for anything you want, 7-inch diameter if you happen to have the pipe. The particular model of drill rig we used, if you wanted a larger diameter pipe, say a 16 or 18 or 20-inch diameter pipe, I think it'd be best to go to a larger drill rig because of torque and mechanical considerations. I guess that's the last of the slides. It looked like the bolt burned out.
So if I haven't missed anything, I won't say too much about the tricone bits. They are fairly commonly used, and they did work well, with the exception of deeper holes in this ice rock conglomerate I described. There's a strong tendency for whipstocking, where the bit will come down and hit a big mass of basalt boulder like that, and they tend to drift it off. And this causes binding of the rods and other problems. The
the pitfalls to watch out for, especially when using compressed air, is the fact that the compressed air introduces heat, and this coupled with frictional heat from the drilling melts the permafrost and forms a dense sticky mud which isn't cleared from the hole very efficiently. And if for any reason drilling stops, you better get your tools out of the hole fast, because this mud freezes very quickly. The best drilling fluid we found for practical purposes was simply seawater, which is at a temperature, freezes at a temperature lower than the melting point of freshwater ice, and therefore it doesn't melt the sides of the hole and cause rock fragments to fall in and jam the bits. Antifreeze or chilled fuel oil can be used in the same way, and it has been used in the Arctic, but you're dealing with a more expensive drilling fluid, and you have to collar the hole and make sure you can recover it and recirculate it enough times to make it efficient. I think I've covered just about everything. I think the tube coring drill, as we call it, could have a lot of application in the Arctic. Many of the conditions are better. The permafrost is certainly warmer, and frozen silt at 31 degrees can be augered with power augers. I know the Alaska Railroad has put down 16-inch diameter holes in frozen silt with not much trouble at all. But in places where it's rocky, it doesn't take much of a rock to stop an auger in frozen soil. And for application or use in the Arctic, I think this has real application for a lot of construction drilling, putting in piling and things like that, because it just drills through everything and is quite efficient up to depths of 9 to 12 feet or so. I think that's about all I have. If there are any questions, I'll be glad to.
Thank you, Mr. Page. Are there any questions for Mr. Page? Yes.
I would just like to know if you had any trouble breaking off in the 14 inch diameter course. Yeah, solid rock, you didn't have a little bit deep. And we lucked out. I want to go over and come down before it did break off. It could be real bad. You didn't have any rock to be very strong.
There's a good deal of interest in the McMurdo area, Ross Ice Shelf, drilling through the Ross Ice Shelf, a large enough diameter hole for oceanographers and marine biologists to get under the ice. Is it possible with this equipment, you think, to drill a hole of? Are there any other questions for Mr. Page?
What type of backfill material or slurry is used for backfill the hole around the pile of holes? Any
special? Well, down in the ice water, they just use fresh water. At the time, they were just manually mixed up dirt and water and slowly back in. Pretty tight. Now they are constructing a war facility that is the three war space is supported by piling, 54-5-line steel piling, that is placed in the hole drilled and saving these fast tracks. And this piling is frozen in the fresh water. This is the building experimental section now. There is a lot of work. what it was used to increase the pile, not in the hole.
There's some indication around this conference that man interferes with the Arctic environment and might cause some induced erosion or other effects in permafrost. Our next paper is going to deal with the subject of man-induced erosion in permafrost. The speaker is Robert Llewellyn, Arctic Research Manager of the Continental Shelf Data System in Denver. Llewellyn here? Sorry, yes, I see you.
Good morning. I'd like to say hello to those Arctic friends of mine who I see in the audience, and also to welcome the Houstonians, which are in fairly good number also. This handout that's coming around is the abstract and the illustrations which cover the case history of some thermal erosion in fluvial environment, which Dr. Brown of the Cold Regions Lab and myself have been working on. This was a side project. It was not the main reason we were in the Arctic. However, we became quite interested in it, and I thought it would be of interest to you folks here, and especially to the oil people. We're trying to come up with some applied material now, which can be used by the industry and by those of you who are interested in the tundra areas. I would like to acknowledge the very grateful support of the Naval Arctic Research Lab, of the Cold Regions Lab, and of the Arctic Institute of North America. I would also like to thank and ask the support of my Arctic superiors, Max Brewer and Max Britton and Mr. Fackler that's in the audience, and John Reed and numerous others, to keep me straight on this thing, because some of the things that have occurred or why they were done, I am not sure of the reasons, but I'm sure that they might have some comments on it. May we have the first slide, please? And the lights. Focus. I'll be discussing the Footprint Creek Drainage Basin. This is Middle Salt Lake, as you can well see. The lab is located here. The native village is located here. We'll be discussing this stream in this portion. This was the original drainage basin, which amounted to about 1 square kilometer in area. The petroleum activity associated with PET 4 in about 1945 cut a caterpillar trench through this area to drain Footprint Lake into this basin. Another trench was cut here from Dry Lake into Footprint. This is the location of the present Barrow gas field at this point. The increased watershed here, or drainage basin, applied a much heavier discharge, of course, to this small stream, which was in equilibrium with its smaller drainage basin. Also, man operating in this Point Barrow area breached a canal through the beach here into the ocean, draining Middle Salt Lake. Its elevation used to stand, the water surface elevation, at about 2.5 meters above sea level. The draining put it down at about 20 centimeters above sea level, and in some cases it's right at sea level, depending upon the opening of the channel and whatnot. But it appears, and this again is the point where I'll have to call on Dr. Brewer and some of them to straighten me out, but from the aerial photography that I have since 1945, it appears that this entire area behind the beach would flood because of the runoff waters from the tundra. Now, man's activity around ARL and at the camp, they were restricted to their movements onto the tundra because of this water, the high water that would come behind the camp. So therefore, I assume that the reason for draining Middle Salt Lake was to lower the water behind the camp and thereby supply greater access to the tundra areas. And I assume the draining in 1950, and again, hopefully Dr. Britton can straighten me out, the draining in 1950 of footprint and dry was to provide access to the gas well area across these lake beds. Next slide, please. This is an aerial photograph. Here's dry lake before it was drained. Footprint, here's the lake basin, which was in equilibrium with Footprint Creek. And you can see the high stand, or the 2.5 meter elevation water level in Middle Salt Lagoon there, Middle Salt Lake. Now, this was a condition that existed prior to man's disturbing the area. And I'm not trying to make a case as to whether he did what he felt was correct or not. We're just merely stating a case as to what happened as a result of all this. Next slide, please. Focus. This is another aerial photograph showing the tracked areas from vehicles, water hauling vehicles mainly, moving in this area. The high stand of water in Middle Salt Lagoon used to pond water up into this neck. It was sort of like a drowned valley. Now, when we lowered the water level in Middle Salt Lagoon, it exposed this lake bottom here, and this channel became entrenched in this segment. And then a nick point, as we call it, or a break in slope, was developed where we had a stream developed on tundra, and it broke through the tundra and was now down on the permafrost as it moved towards Middle Salt Lagoon there. You can see the gullies that have developed on the side. We'll have some close-up of those. Next slide, please. Here is the sequence. This is just a few of the many, many missions that exist of aerial photography on the North Slope. There has been a fantastic amount of photography. Some of it is very poor, some of it is good. But I was able to utilize first the 1945 photographs, which illustrate the normal high stand of water prior to man's activity. On the 1949 photograph, you can see the lake has been drained. This is a typical beaded stream, tundra in the bottom, sedges, grasses on the side, and there has been no entrenchment. It's just merely showing the draining of the Middle Salt Lake. Here is the entrenchment as we see it in 1956. The entrenchment was caused by the lower base level of Middle Salt Lake and by the draining of Footprint and Dry Lake. Then here on the right we have the 1964 Krell photography showing the increased entrenchment, the widening of your stream in this area, and the thermokarst, or the thermal erosion, that is now moving upstream. And this erosion, as it moves upstream from a position down here in 1952, is illustrated in that handout that you have. And incidentally, the printer may have goofed and left out a couple of sheets, and I hope we have plenty. Next slide, please. This is a sequence of photographs to show you the runoff characteristics of this particular creek. And I wish Carl were here to make a comment in that the breakup on many of these Arctic streams is quite a bit different from what he has illustrated north of town here. We're continuing to make observations on these areas, and they're quite dramatic. In some cases, we get tremendous ice loads, and for the petroleum people, if they were to casually put in pilings, they're liable to have some ice problems that they weren't aware of. This shows the valley as spring thaw approaches. Next slide, please. We'll go through these very rapidly. This is the first day of runoff. Next slide. Second day of runoff. Next slide. There's the third day. Next slide. Fourth day. Next slide. And this is about a week later then from the last slide. So you can see that runoff comes very rapidly. It initially, in this size of stream, runs over a snow channel, entrenches itself down into the snow channel, and finally arrives on top of the sediments. Now, the speed at which this water can travel this distance downward, this vertical distance from the snow down onto the sediments, depends upon the temperature of the water also. All right, if there's any way in which we can alter this flow of water or hold up the discharge by making a snow road, for example, or a snow dam, then we can allow this solar energy to really charge up the water thermally. And then when it comes down through these areas, it can quite easily get underneath these tundra mat portions and erode the permafrost very rapidly and very effectively. Next slide. This shows what we call the nick point, or the headward retreat of the falls. You can see that in some cases the water just cutting down underneath the Niagara type example, removing the sediments. The water is very pure, you might say. It's chemically it's very clean also above the falls. It only becomes charged with sediments below this area. It's running on tundra here, it's running on sediments to the right. You can see the niching that occurs on the side and the slumping down of the tundra. Next slide. Is that in focus? You can see the water is running laterally, and again, this lateral capacity to cut depends upon the thermal characteristics of the water, and that if it's very warm, it can remove this material very fast. It undercuts, and then it'll just spall off or fall off into the stream. Next slide. Here's another portion showing where a large block had been undercut and has fallen off into the stream. These blocks are eroded away quite rapidly. And this is also a function of the thickness of the tundra mat. The tundra mat in some cases is very thin in this area, and in some cases it's very thick, which offers tremendous resistance to erosion. Next slide. This is one of the portions of where the channel is in the snow, and we were making an attempt to gauge the runoff in this particular example. Most of the discharge will normally run off in this type of a channel prior to arriving on top of the sediments or coming in contact with the permafrost, and that is that I'm saying before it comes in contact where it can do some harmful thermal erosion or some catastrophic type things. Next slide. This is the downstream portion of the stream. You can see here where water had moved on top of the snow. It entrenched down through the snow, and again, as I've said before, it's down in the sediments now. Depending on how long and at what discharge we have here in this portion, we can get considerable erosion or practically none at all. Next slide. This is the snow road, which was constructed in the winter of 1963 and 1964 as a result of a storm at Barrow, Alaska in October of 63. Their fresh water supply was contaminated, and they had to construct this road and haul water from McRovick Lake, which is beyond the Barrow gas field. The Barrow wells are right over here in this vicinity. The water haulers used this road to Ikrovik to haul the water back and forth to the Navy camp. Now you can see that it formed a very good barrier to the normal flow of water. Everything to the left was towards Dry Lake and was held back and was thermally loaded. What was to the right normally drained out through the stream. Next slide, please. This is a photograph, aerial oblique again, of Dry Lake, and you can see the portion in here, the cat portion in here, of the cat trail rather, is still plugged, but it's a matter of a few days when these areas release the water downstream. Here's the gas wells again at Barrow. Next slide. This shows the runoff at Footprint Creek. This is the downstream section that we were looking at. The nick point is back up around the curve, but you can see the tundra waters collecting from the melting snow, and they flow down on top of the snow down out into Middle Salt Lake. Next slide. This illustrates what we call a thermal erosional niche. It's caused by these warm waters cutting laterally. And this is the type of erosion that occurred in the 1964 runoff. The water was effectively held up by the activity of man on the snow road, and when it came down, it was heavily charged thermally and again eroded these niches. Next slide. Could we get that picture down a little bit on the screen? This is looking in the other direction of that same niche, and after the water stage falls, then the material simply spalls off and just stacks up like this, and depending on the timing and when you're there, sometimes you notice these things and sometimes you don't, but in these particular cases, we had sequential photography on a lot of this stream. But this is what these niches look like once they're collapsed. Next slide. Focus, please. This shows the ice lensing in the fine sands and silts in this particular area. And this material is cemented only by ice, and all it takes is the warm waters to start this material eroding. Next slide. Here's another shot showing the silts and fine sands and the large amount of ice that makes up the ground mass here. These are about a centimeter across, these little soil pads. Next slide. In this area, we're looking at what was once a lake bed with very little ice in it. Then we come into marine sediments down here, which is quite heavily charged with ice and in which most of the erosion occurs. Next slide. Depending on the configuration of this neck point, in 1964, we expected a very heavy runoff, which we did get. But the erosion or the neck point retreat, as you'll notice on that handout, is very slight. And this is because the mat, this tundra vegetative mat can lie down in front like this and form a very resistant surface for that water to jet over. And again, it's a function of where the snowpack was, how the frozen conditions were in this area. And if we had an edge such as this during spring runoff, then we could expect quite a bit of retreat. But in 64, it was of this nature, and we got very little retreat. Next slide. This is another aerial oblique of that Footprint Creek area. You can see the tundra here, the typical beaded stream, the entrenched portions or the eroded portions in here, the gully erosion that's developing here. Now normally you'll hear of a lot of examples of where the runoff waters move down the tracks and cause erosion of the permafrost. Well, in this particular case, there was a small drainage basin off here to the northwest, and the water moved down through this gully, which is now eroded to about a meter and a half deep. And you can see the detour which they've made, which continues the erosion, incidentally. Next slide. This is a photograph of that gully that I just pointed out, showing the thermal erosion of the permafrost. Next slide. Another view of it. This was made from water hauling vehicles again operating in that area. Next slide. This shows a before and after shot. In 1963, we set the climatic extreme for precipitation in 1963 and 1964 at Barrow. In 63, we had the maximum, and we first noticed that something was taking place over here with this initial erosion. And then a few weeks later, the next spring to be exact, we took this shot on the right, showing how the erosion had progressed back up to this point. And this rapid erosion and large lateral erosion was due to this heavy precipitation in 1963. Then with the snow road in the winter of 63 and 64, we expected a lot of headward retreat. We got very little headward retreat at the neck point, but we did get a lot of this thermal niching. We set the climatic extreme again in 1964 by very low precipitation, and the runoff was very, very slight, only a small amount of niching over here on this side and very little neck point retreat again. Next slide. This is a photograph when Jerry was up there in 1962. We took this shot of a typical beaded pool along a beaded stream on the tundra. You can see the sedges down here in the bottom. Here's this tundra mat lying over, which we thought was fairly stable at the time. Next slide shows the difference. There's the same area. I've been in quite a few arguments with people. They say the slides are mixed up. The next slide. This shows the downstream portion, which Jerry had photographed in 1957, and he didn't really know why. He thought it had some Pleistocene implications. And incidentally, I should acknowledge the work of Robert Rex, who worked up there in 1952 in this particular area. And he had mapped this for future references, but he didn't state why. I think we're beginning to find out. Anyway, this is a photograph Jerry took in 57, and this is the one I took in 67. Next. So you can see that the channel has widened and has deepened quite a bit. Next slide. Well, this is just a comparison of the two in case you, it's hard to tell sometimes from the other two in sequence, but you can see the narrow shallow channel versus the wide deep one here. Next slide. Here's one of the ice wedges which melt out and form these beaded pools, as we call them. In some cases, we find this contraction crack down through the tundra surface into the ice, and this is an avenue for the runoff waters to get down into the frozen material, into the ice, and erode it very rapidly. When it does do this, and this is the case in the Footprint Creek area, we had a tremendous amount of piping effect, underground flow under the tundra mat, and it was very effective in eroding out the sediments. Next photograph. Here's a cross section showing one of the pools here. Is that in focus? Showing one of the pools which is formed by the ice wedges. Here's a couple of ice wedges here that have melted out and formed these pools. We have this seasonal thaw zone here and the permafrost here. Once it gets down through the tundra mat and through the seasonal thaw zone into the permafrost, then you can thermally erode out quite large areas. Next slide. This shows the thaw season precipitation on the top, the average line, and you can see since the draining of Footprint and Dry, we had fairly normal precip all the way across until 1963, and then the low extreme in 64 there. This is the winter precip. We're trying to utilize this to determine what the drainage conditions are going to be like in the spring. What's the snowpack like? What kind of runoff can we expect? What is the erosion going to be like? Next slide. This shows, again, just the 63, 64, and the normal precip that we can expect in that area. In 63, we had 4.73 inches and only 0.9 inches. In 1964, with the normal being about 2.7. Next slide. We see similar examples on the tundra today in nature. In other words, these nick point retreats are not caused by man in every case. We do see nick points such as this retreating up a stream, but usually they're very small as compared to the Footprint Creek example, which is sort of catastrophic, actually. Next slide. This is included in the handout to show you the water temperatures and also the relationship of the normal spring runoff, when it starts, the end of runoff, and the lag caused by the construction of the snow road, and then the final drain condition when there's just a trickle coming off of the tundra. Next slide. Again, the runoff conditions are controlled by what has happened in that drainage basin. Here's an example of when a cat train went through, cleared the snow from the tundra. Now, there was no more precipitation, solid form, after this to close up this trench, and this formed an avenue for runoff waters. And it also ecologically has its implications. Next slide. You can see the green area as a result of this, and I imagine we had a few examples of this in Prudhoe Bay area after being there last winter. Next slide. Also, the conditions of the tundra and of these watersheds vary in the types of runoff that you can get. On the left, you see where a similar type vehicle made approximately 4 passes a day for 60 days. We had about 2 passes a day for 60 days on the right. This erosion here was caused by the track vehicles. In the wet year of 1963, this in the dry year of 1964.